a production of South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
Good morning. Thank you for joining us. My name is Kelsey Pritchard with the Governor's Office, and today with Governor Dugard, we have the Secretary of the State Department of Transportation, Darren Bergquist. Just a reminder to everyone on the phone, please mute your lines by pressing star 6, and you can unmute during the Q&A portion by pressing pound 6. And everyone in the room, just please use the microphones at the table. And with that, I'll turn it over to Governor Dennis Dugard.
Thank you, Kelsey, and thank you, everyone, for joining us for this news conference. I want to begin today by expressing my pleasure that Senate Bill 1 passed the Senate yesterday. That was the Highway Financing Committee's bill that was introduced in the Senate. It had a number of amendments, I think 7 amendments in all. The bill was taken from what was the committee's proposal and transformed into largely what had been the proposal I had offered in the State of the State, and is found in House Bill 1131. And then it was amended from there, you know, 5-6 more times than that. I like some amendments better than others, but all things considered, I'm pleased that the bill passed the Senate, and yet I know it's still early. The House has, to some degree, in House Transportation, exerted its influence through that committee on the 1131. Then since then, of course, it's been referred to House State Affairs, and they will take it up on Wednesday. And what will happen there, I don't really know, but I'm hoping that there will be support for something coming out of the House, and that in the end we'll have a conference committee that finds that sweet spot, that identifies a mix of ingredients that both houses can support with a 2/3 vote. So we'll see how it goes, but certainly the first and most important thing is that a bill in one form or another passes each House of the legislature, and at least that's happened in the Senate thus far. So, and Darren, I know, has been working hard to provide the committee members lots of information.
We're hearing some noise on the phone. Is there somebody who doesn't have their line muted? Can you please press
to start the
star 6?
Recording, press 1 to cancel.
Okay, thanks.
So I guess that's all I wanted to say about transportation.
Conference record has joined the conference.
Darren, I know, has worked hard to get the legislators all the information that they're asking for, and certainly there's lots of things to be considered, lots of amendments and lots of impact that people want to understand what those amendments do, and Darren works pretty hard to get that information out. So with that, I'll open it up to questions about highway funding or any other topic.
Governor, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
Governor, Mark Swartzel with the Dakota News Network. You mentioned some amendments you like better than others. Can you expand a little bit on that?
Well, one key element that I see is the gas tax in South Dakota has been at 22 cents a gallon since 1999. 16 years it's been at that level. And in that time frame, construction costs have more than doubled. And so we're only able to buy a little bit less than half of what we used to buy with the gas tax dollars that come into our hands. So there are a couple of amendments to my proposal. My proposal was to raise the gas tax by 2 cents a year, every year going forward, and I had not put an end date on that. One version in the Senate that passed yesterday out of the full Senate would cap that to an 8-year time frame, so essentially a 16-cent increase. And that is certainly better than no increase, but it doesn't achieve a full recovery of the purchasing price of those dollars. We still will be buying less with those dollars than we did in 1999. The House version, as it stands today, after amendments in the House Transportation Committee, would limit the 2 cent a year increase to 15 years, and that would get us a little bit beyond the purchasing power that we had in 1999, assuming there's no raise in construction costs over the next 15 years, which of course is very unlikely. So I do prefer the 15-year time frame over which we'd see 2 cents a gallon increase every year. I like the very gradual and very small increase over time. I think it's something consumers would be better able to adapt to. I understand the reluctance to jump the gas tax up to where construction costs have risen. That'd be a big jump and be harder for consumers to adapt to. So that's one example of the preferred amendment.
Jackie, you have a question?
Yeah, so what about the, I think in the Senate, it's a little confusing for me and probably everybody, but
sure.
They did amend ability for the townships to raise a levy. I think it has to be referred or go to a vote of the people first, and there was a cap maybe on that. Could you maybe explain that a little bit and what your views are on that, if,
sure.
if that's something you agree
with? The proposal
with?
That I had put forward had two elements that allowed local governments to raise property taxes. At the county level, in law today, counties have the ability to raise their levy up to $1.20 per thousand. And some counties maybe have that levy today at that full amount. Do they, Darren? Do you know?
No, I don't think anybody's at the max.
Nobody's at the max, but there are some counties that have already enacted a levy to some degree within that $1.20 a thousand range, zero to $1.20. But the limitation that's in statute today is counties can only raise that money to be used to match federal dollars. And one of the proposals that I have in our bill would swap all the federal dollars for state dollars, because if you are a county and you're getting federal dollars, you can only spend those dollars on certain roads that are eligible for federal aid. So if you're, let's say we'll just use Turner County. If you're in Turner County and you've got some federal aid eligible county highways that are in good shape, then that levy does you no good, because you don't need money for those roads. You might need money for other roads that are not federal aid eligible. So right now you can't use the federal money on them, nor does it help you to levy within that $1.20 limitation. The only way you can use that is to match federal dollars, which, of course, as I said, can't be used on that road that you want to fix. So by swapping out the state and federal dollars, then they would no longer be restricted to federal aid eligible. But, of course, they still would not be able to spend that money if the statute still contains language that only allows them to levy the $1.20 and match federal dollars. So the two things that my bill does is swap the federal for state dollars, so they're no longer restricted as to what roads they spend those non-local dollars on. And then it also amends the statute to remove the provision that the $1.20 levy can only be used to match federal dollars. It could be used for any kind of road construction. Yesterday's the other thing in my bill gave townships the ability to levy up to 50 cents a thousand for local township roads. Neither of those levies under the bill that I have proposed would be constrained by the current property tax limitation ceilings. They certainly would be referable, But they wouldn't, so if the county commission or the township board passed a resolution to raise the levy, the citizens could collect signatures and put it to a vote of the citizens. The amendment that passed yesterday in the Senate would make that referral automatic. Well, if you think about it, right now, local governments can raise their property taxes today, and it is referred to the people if it's beyond the property tax limitation. So in a way, it doesn't give the locals any more authority than they already have today with the amendment that was passed by the Senate. It essentially says all these changes in law, the practical effect will be no change. So that is. I guess I would prefer not to have that amendment, because I think if we want to give local governments the ability to raise more dollars for highways and roads in some fashion, then we should give them more. And with the amendment, it essentially undoes what the bill would do in terms of giving them more ability to raise money. It's not a poison pill, though. You know, if the bill passes with that in it, I certainly would sign it, because I would rather have half a loaf than no loaf.
Do you have any questions on the line? And do you have another question, Jackie?
No, go ahead.
There was a measure, this is getting off road funding a little bit, but there was a measure that did not pass the House yesterday that would have gotten rid of the cap, I believe, on property taxes. Can you speak to put the property tax issue right now? I know that counties and municipalities said they really need help with more funding. Do you agree with what the House did in the end?
I do. I think that the effort that I've undertaken through this transportation bill will give local governments a lot more money. And to the extent that their overall budget is under pressure because of transportation needs, in part, if you look at most counties and talk to them, where is the pressure in your budget? It's generally law enforcement and transportation. That's where they feel they don't have enough money. To the extent that you can relieve the pressure on the transportation side, that should also help indirectly with the law enforcement side. So I think if this transportation bill passes, that's going to help local governments to a large degree. We also have to remember, too, that it was just in 2011 and 2013 that the license plate fees were raised, collectively $30 million, and the local units of government were getting $50 million. Now they're getting $80 million. So I really think it's pretty early on to judge whether or not they've been given enough additional tax dollars to say we should give them still more. We should remove the limitation. And also remember that the property tax limitation does not restrict them to a flat dollar amount. It rises every year. It rises every year. But it only rises to the extent that inflation rises or there's been new construction. And especially in counties and municipalities like the Sioux Falls area, where there's very significant new construction, there's been a fair amount of ability to raise lots more money through these levies, however they may be constrained. The levies alone, with the new construction valuation, still raises a lot more dollars under existing law. So what happened in the House was to preserve existing law, and I support that.
Any other questions? Okay, go for it.
It sounds like there's maybe some talk on the Medicaid front for the providers coming together and coming to an agreement to maybe take less lower payments so to get Medicaid expansion, some sort of bill passed. Is that correct? Is that what you're hearing as well? And if that, if something like that comes out, do you think Medicaid expansion might be able to get passed through the legislature this year?
What I know is occurring is the Medicaid providers and their representatives are having meetings with my staff, with the Secretary of Health and others about Medicaid, both in terms of examining the current Medicaid program and how it is managed, and changes that we have been implementing over the last several years, what has been the impact of those changes. There was not as much information, I would say, in their hands about how that was working. And so we've had a lot of good conversation, very cordial and positive conversation that helps everyone's level of understanding about what is happening in the Medicaid arena. For example, we have 116,000 people on Medicaid today. Of those, there's maybe 22,000 or so that have chronic conditions. And one of the things that the Affordable Care Act allowed was it allows states to amend their Medicaid plan to engage these people a little more proactively, to help them help themselves, to monitor and regulate their blood pressure or their diabetes, these chronic conditions that, if treated, people can live with and still have good quality of life, but if untreated or not well managed, cause emergency room visits, cause other kinds of disease states to be exacerbated. And so people who have diabetes or have high blood pressure or other chronic diseases, we want to make sure if they're on Medicaid that we are doing what we can to help them manage those conditions so they don't end up being much more expensive. Now, of those 22,000, I want to say 60% are what I would call well-managed today. They're not high utilizers. So they might be the kind of people that we would engage with very proactively if they were high utilizers, but they are self-managing pretty well today. Doesn't mean we don't want to keep in communication and make sure that continues. But then of the other 40% or so, we want to, they're in second and third and fourth tiers, fourth being the highest utilizers, the most serious chronic conditions. And we want to actively engage with those people to make sure that they're managing their conditions well. Our hope is that by doing that, you drive the cost of Medicaid down because people are using less expensive treatments and maintaining their care so they don't come into the emergency room, they don't have very severe, they don't have a heart attack or a stroke because they weren't managing their blood pressure, but instead we're just paying for modest amounts of blood pressure medication. So those are the kinds of conversations that we've been having about home health homes is the lingo, health homes, where some of the problems we have though today are still a consequence of our rural nature as a state. We've got some of these people with the chronic conditions where there is no primary care provider in their county. And so we've got to figure out a way to help them via electronic communication or some other way. And so we're just getting into these health homes. We've been into them maybe a year, and we're still working on it. But those are conversations we've had. And then there was also some conversations with the Medicaid providers about, you know, there was statements like, why don't we get a waiver so that we can, you know, expand to partial populations? Well, it doesn't work quite that way. And there's a lot of good communication that I think is important, because if you want to make any kind of policy changes, it's important that everyone understand the facts and today's reality and the costs. There was also a fair amount of time that we spent going through the actuarial studies that were done a couple of years ago when we were looking at what would it cost to expand to the new Medicaid eligible population. How many are, you know, up to 100% of federal poverty level? How many are between 100 and 138%? How many are single? How many have children? How many already have insurance? All those facts. We went through a lot of that data to make sure there was, again, understanding of how we are coming up with the costs, because certainly one of the largest obstacles to expansion is the cost. We just don't have the state dollars. By the time you get to 2019 or 2020, we're talking about $36 million. We just don't have that to spend unless we cut everyone else. And that's not a good solution. So we've had great conversations, I would say, and they continue.
Any other questions? All right, well, thank you for joining us.
Yep, thank you. Thanks, everyone.